Yeah, I think it's another year. Excuse me, sir. Excuse me. How's your loan, Eric? Did they give you a loan? He must be economically viable. There's a man with a smile on his face. He looks like a happy customer. That's what an economically viable person looks like.
Good morning, Winter Park. You're just tuning in to WPRK, Winter Park, Florida. And here we go. It's Punkonomics with Dr. Benny Balick.
Good morning.
Today's...
today's guest is
Corey Carroll.
And Jay Gordon's on his way. The parking catastrophe out there.
It wasn't that bad, actually. I don't know if he's trying to park on campus, he's probably...
Oh, yeah, forget it.
Ah, there he is!
All right.
We're going to be sharing microphones a little bit. Wait, I don't know. We could... Whatever.
Whatever.
Yeah. Don't put yourself in the corner there. Sharing microphones is fine, not a problem.
How you doing?
I'm in the studio. Of course I'm in a corner. Everything's a corner.
Yeah, you're right. Everything is a corner in the studio, just
here,
about.
Are we going to talk math? No. Don't start Jay on that one. Can't shut him up if you start talking about math.
Jay, could you give us a quick analysis of why everything is in the corner in the studio?
No.
Right.
Sometimes it is important to refuse the question. You know? No, and I have to apologize for, my voice is, it'll come out through the phlegm. I mean, I finally got that nasty cold that's running around campus. I'm sure it's all over the region. And I'd like to, just...
Jay's backing up.
It's probably full. It's probably too late. You're exposed, you know. But in all seriousness, I still see a whole lot of boys not washing their hands after they leave the toilet. I know about the girls because I obviously don't have direct experience there. But that is just absolutely revolting and disgusting. And I'm always very, really, I'm like almost, I get a tick. I'm going to get you. But then I say that, that may be inappropriate.
So what's the topic for today?
Oh, dear. It's going to be a nasty one. It's kind of Earth Day, right?
It's close.
And like I always say, I like it. It's on purpose, in fact. I think it's an interesting idea to have this bleed between the class, the community. Got two alumni right here. The radio station, kind of mix it all up. So I've been talking about this stuff for I've been talking about a book came out. This stuff in class, in two of my classes where it's relevant. To cut a long story short, we're going to talk environmentalism and we're going to talk radical environmentalism and radical thought in general. We'll try and define it a little bit, maybe, but also we will make sure, at least to start, when we say radical, often people think, left, right, red flag waving, different flavors of communist or socialist. No, there's plenty of radical on the right. So you're thinking, you mean like neo-Nazis and nut jobs, militia, racists? Well, yeah, they're there, shout out to all you neo-Nazis out there.
Probably have one listener.
I got a problem with you. I got many serious problems with you. But I am willing to talk. I think we should talk. We talk. We should talk with anybody. Tell them why we think they're completely messed up. No problem. But you know, just I'm not listening is not the issue. And there's plenty of hard right wingers, very susceptible, you know, typically very suspicious of government, etc. That need to be in on this conversation. You know?
Are you hinting at our next guest?
Which one is that? Wait, I'm not in the loop. Which is fine by me.
No, it's
ah, maybe to get. Well, yeah. I mean, I do want to. We have tried to get conservatives, you know, like libertarians, and not so successful yet. I mean, I don't know why, really.
Yeah, I ran into one of them yesterday, a fellow close student of mine, and it's actually Eddie, which is, he's listening.
Yeah,
we've been saying, hey, come here and, you know, argue your point, you know, since we started.
Yeah.
So there you go.
And anyway. I'm really awfully, if apart from my depression, you know, anybody reads my blog probably heard that I in despair last afternoon. So you tried to cry it out that my depression is not clinical; it's perfectly rational and empirical. In other words, fact based.
Empirical
and rational depression, not clinical.
I like
at all,
that.
You know?
Empirical.
I mean, if you're not depressed, then what's your problem? You know, then what's going on with you? So really, I am, though, somewhat encouraged with the increasing dialogue, you know, could be symbolized, you know, when Immortal Technique comes and talks on Alex Jones, you know. So I want to say to libertarians, and I'm going to actively, you know, want to reach out to that, to people, to the radicals on all sides, those who realize that something's horribly wrong with this picture. That the information's lies, the processes are destructive, and today, because of the environmental side of radicalism, we'll kind of look at the horror, the genocide. You know, don't want to write off, get on like my insanity horse, you know. But we, the genocide, but what the hell, you know? I mean, like Derek Jensen's so effective in his Holocaust discussion about the Holocaust going on, you know, the it's going on right now. You know, and I grew up like many, you know, Jews from East Europe, asking what all the good people in the world doing when they were gassing my people, you know, and my family. And now I know. I'm 47. Now I know. Why do I know? Because here we are. That's what they were doing: hanging out, having a cup of coffee. Well, actually, we could, but no. You know, talking about stuff because, you know, people are dying by the thousands every day, you know, at least as fast as they were in East Europe in the mid-40s, you know? It's going on today. Let's talk about Bangladesh, right? I mean, who's the terrorist, right? They pulled out almost 300 last I checked this morning. They'll finish with 800 people sewing our clothes, you know? And they knew it was going to fall, and nobody cares. And, you know, disposable people, you know. I actually have that, I coined that term, disposable labor. I have it in the law journal. really, that's the most thing, because it's a great term. We have to, you know, claim our turf in this business, too. But, so, outrage, the Holocaust is going on, you know, environment. But animals, plants are being destroyed dramatically. Maybe we can go there, you know, but I find it hard, actually. That's the most difficult part for me to follow these radical environmentalists, is to, you know, I care about the fauna in so much as I realize that over 1 billion people are currently starving as we speak, you know. Another one. I just got to do it, and then I shut up for a little while, I promise. You know, who's the terrorist, right? When Goldman Sachs was playing some interesting market games in the oil commodity markets right after the financial crisis, which they are overwhelmingly responsible in engineering on purpose for profit, they rose... the food prices in the world rose by 40%, and estimated 100 million people died. So, you know... Right, you know, your Nazis, you know, you gotta catch up here because, you know, Wall Street's, you know, you're choir boys next to those dudes, aren't you? But then it's indirect, right? These people are dying somewhere, you know? They're like taking their last breaths right now, you know, crushed by buildings in Bangladesh and outskirts of Dhaka. You know, they're starving out there all over the world. We don't see them, right? We don't, you know, there's no direct bullet in the head going on.
Well, actually, I think we do see them. It's just that we're desensitized because we're so used to it happening. And because the media is pretty much controlled or constrained as far as the information is concerned here, I think we just come to accept, you know, the devastation in the world as part of life.
Yeah. Well, well, that's the president.
I mean, wrongly so, but that's what's happening.
No, I see
complete,
what you're saying.
Yeah. Completely desensitized.
It's kind of normal, right?
Right.
Yeah, it's normal. Huh? It just goes on. But of course, but is it? First of all, it does. You know, there are moments even in civilized society, which I don't think in our context today, civilization is not a good word, right? It's a pejorative term. There are better moments and worse moments. I mean, so you know, not, it's never. You know, the struggle goes on always, but there are moments where every year maybe a few less people are starving, and there are moments where it is, you know, open season on humanity.
Right. The thing is, when you look at the big picture, the oppressors, in my opinion, are the small group, and we are the majority. And for everybody not to take charge, you know, or change things, it just tells you how people have just become complacent, or because we are an individualist society, at least on our part of the world, we tend to more care about ourselves than one another. And
but we can raise awareness, because I can't help, but, you know, we're all in on it, right? Let's not get all hoti-toti here, right? We're all in on it. Where's the clothing? Where the clothing we're all wearing here, from our underwears, our jeans. My jeans are from Target. I believe so is my underwear. This is from some online something. You know, who made them? Those ladies, yeah. Those young girls that are currently taking their last breaths and dying in horrible, horrible agony in that building in Bangladesh and millions of buildings like it around the poor world. So I'm in on it. I'm in on it too, right? I mean, sure, there's degrees, I suppose, right? Just like there is the chief, exterminator in the concentration camp, and there's just the people who kind of looking at Dachau down the street and saying, I wonder, those chimneys sure smells funny. Huh? It's a sausage factory. That's an old Jewish joke. Because, we didn't know. Yeah, you thought it was a sausage factory, didn't you? That sweet, acrid smell of burning flesh, eh?
Yeah, I just had to throw something out here, just kind of something a bit
esoteric.
Right? Yeah. And also, if somebody doesn't say something soon, Ben's just going to run
my
the whole show.
My head's going to go like,
yeah. So, I mean, you know, just as a different line altogether, right? You almost have to kind of wonder, though, if there isn't just something intrinsic in civilization that kind of causes it to basically collapse itself. I mean, there's this theory, it's called Fermi's paradox, right? And it's based on Drake's equation. Drake's equation is, you know, basically you look at the probability of life in the universe through a series of, you know, diminishing probabilities. You put a set of filters, right? And you have trillions and trillions of planets out there. You know, you should theoretically have millions that have life, but, you know, why aren't we hearing transmissions from them? Why aren't we communicating with them? And the idea is, it's Fermi's paradox. It's basically that, you know, civilizations, they grow and become complex, and then eventually they destroy themselves. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, it might not really be avoidable. Because if you think about it, Ben, you know, there's someone like yourself and, you know, maybe a handful of people, right, who are pointing out these issues. But, you know, I mean, how much noise is out there that drowns out your voice?
Right.
And I think that's a...
It's depressing. I didn't come here with like this to be the smile guy, but...
Yeah, I think that's a good place to...
Yeah. I'm counting on you, man.
Okay, I'll take that role.
I think that's a good place to start by asking the question whether or not there's something inherent in civilization that causes it to collapse. Derek Jensen argues... I mean, he has this great definition of civilization, where he says, look, civilization is unsustainable by definition because it is a culture, it is an institution that promotes the growth of cities, which are resourceless entities, right? So meaning that cities have to rely on routine importation of resources, right? And of course, Dr. Balak can tell you about, you know, early cities and how they went into the countryside and destroyed, you know, the technology and shifted people off the land so that they would come to work in the cities, and, you know, so that the land would be available for exploitation and so on and so forth.
Same old, been going on for 12,000 years.
Right, and that's what we do, right? That's what America did. When it came here, it exploited the land, it moved out west, and then after that, became obsessed with places like Latin America, right? Tried to control it.
It spawned like a virus.
Right. Mm-hmm. And that's why we have things like, say, constant wars. The wars aren't to protect us from terrorism or to defend ourselves. The wars are to defend the interests of the elite, of rich people.
And over resources.
Right.
There's no war about anything else but resources.
And resources, to control resources, to maintain, you know, a complex sort of civilization. You know, people kind of ask, when we talk about wars, right, my friends often ask, you know, well, if the U.S. is engaged in hostilities with the Middle East to control oil, why don't they set something up where, you know, they have a 60-40 instead of an 80-20 or a 70-30? And, you have to say that if we had that, you know, if we just said, okay, look, you know, the nations can take most of the oil and we'll take 40%, our civilization would collapse. We need complete control of those resources.
You know, I have a slightly different view on the Middle East. And the way I view what the U.S. has done in the Middle East over the last 60 years, it's been more of a game of divide and conquer, really, than anything. Because it's not so much that we needed to control the oil or, you know, the revenues in the oil, even though, I mean, yes, it's been very valuable to us. You know, there could have been substitutes, more damaging substitutes, like the Canadian tar sands, right? But what we've really done is, you know, look at economics, right? Buying power is relative. What we've done is we've debased the Middle East by dividing them against themselves. You know, we play off of these ancient, you know, tribal rivalries, you know, in the Middle East, you know, Shiites and Sunnis. And we've exploited. I mean, you know, in the 70s, Iran, the Shah of Iran had a plan to basically use the nation's oil wealth to reconstitute desert into fertile cropland. And, you know, we didn't like that idea. We fostered a coup. We ousted him. And then next thing you know, Iran remains a net importer of food for the next.
I mean, there's clearly that years. Game. I mean, it's an old imperialist game.
It's divide and conquer. It's simple. And by the way, if you think we're nuts about the U.S., you know, waging offensive wars, that's basically what we do. Look at the Department of Defense. Look at their wish list for their next generation fighter aircraft. We don't even have the current next generation fighter. They're already soliciting, you know, bids from Lockheed Martin and Boeing.
Did they give it a name of an exterminated indigenous peoples?
I didn't know. But I mean, the very first thing is they want an aircraft that's capable of accessing quote unquote denied airspace. How is it a defense measure if you're accessing denied, as in defended, airspace? You know, I mean, these are weapons that are clearly meant to operate outside of our own borders, outside of our own territorial waters. And now, you know, some strategists could probably say the best defense is a good offense. But really, I mean, since the nuclear age,
nobody in the CIA and the Pentagon buy this. I mean, you know, it's that dualistic talk, right?
Right.
You know, the same days where you know, during the early war in Iraq, you know, justification for it, you know, and we're hearing Colin Powell and we're hearing Dick Cheney talking about like weapons of mass destruction, and he's a really nasty guy and he eats babies and whatever. And trust me, I mean, nobody, you know, Saddam Hussein was, you know, I don't think his mama liked him, you know, there's nothing to like, but Rumsfeld actually really liked him back in the day, but that's another story. But
No, at the same time, the very same people were talking to serious people in a completely different language. So, you know, they never bought
that
stuff.
Didn't we sell them their chemical weapons?
Of course. Yeah, I gave them the green light to gas their feet.
Actually, the Germans did, funnily enough. You just love that historical irony. But, I mean, you see, there is that double language, no doubt about it. And that's kind of what some things that you know, to some economists do, those that aren't, you know, on the take, as recently we've mentioned last show, so let's not take it too much. But you can find out stuff. You know, one of the things we're talking in class yesterday is, you know, I'm saying, why do people doubt the climate catastrophe that we're in, you know, not facing, we're well in it, you know? Because billions of dollars are spent by interested groups in the energy sector, which, funnily enough, to my libertarian friends, is probably the most socialistic, if you will, sector, totally supported by taxpayers' money, etc. Right. So it looks like some Soviet nightmare.
Even BP actually
a lot of them.
Used prisoners for the oil spill cleanup, and they were engaged in open.
And they get billions of
slavery.
Subsidies.
So,
yeah.
You know, they said that if the prisoners don't work in these unsafe conditions cleaning up oil, they're going to add to their prison sentences so that they stay in prison longer.
Yeah. But you know, so you look at those oil companies who are sponsoring billions of dollars in economics, as we know that too, you know, buying the entire academic departments to tell us that, oh no, it's all fine. So first of all, I'd like to ask, you know, maybe we have a constitutional lawyer out there. I know very little. I'm a foreigner after all. But right, First Amendment, right? You're not allowed, right, to scream fire in a crowded theater, right?
Right.
But I'd like to know, are you allowed to soothingly say, take it easy, everything's cool, man, relax, in a burning theater? Is that protected by the First Amendment? You know, I was just wondering. But listen, where are they investing the money? They're buying swaths of land in Africa, in Latin America, because they know the food catastrophe is upon us. You know, they're looking for exploitation rights of resources. So the same people who are telling us, no, we're not running out of oil, their actions in the economy reveal that they are investing like they're in a panic about oil.
And that's, so, well, they're investing in the wrong way as well, right?
No
so
doubt.
We just mentioned the whole issue of the tar sands, which, you know, I don't know if anyone knows, is a pretty... It's a pretty nasty technology.
Use Google Earth. You see it from space.
In fairness now, though, you shouldn't label the tar sands as being awful relative to all other oils. Because, I mean, you know, the oil we produce now, especially out in California, right, for all intents and purposes, it has about the same carbon intensity as what's produced up in Canada. So, I mean, let's just be perfectly honest. The oil that's produced in Venezuela is basically, it's actually, it might be even more carbon intense than the tar sands. Yeah, and
how come? Because I guess tar sands are like not done yet, right? I mean,
it's technically called
need to add 100 million years or
it's
something.
It's called bitumen, right?
It's bitumen. That's the stuff that oozed out in, was it Arkansas a couple of weeks ago in some neighborhood?
It has a very high gravity, right? It's a very thick oil, right? It's not like the very light oil that you pull out of Saudi Arabia. Mm. It's not like the very you know, light oil that was originally pulled out of Texas. You know, this stuff is thick. It needs quite a bit of refining. You know, it needs to be in Canada. The reason
you need to put all that energy into creating every barrel of oil. Right?
Yeah. Now, see what they do in Canada, just because it's easy, it's at the surface. They literally mine it. What they do in Venezuela is they do what's called steam-assisted gravity drainage, which they also are starting to do up in Canada. But basically what you do is you take natural gas, you shoot it down into the well with oxygen, and you combust it and you burn it, right? So you're burning fuel to get more fuel out. You help, you know, heat the oil, makes it flow.
So it's kind of so there's other forms of tar sand, maybe as opposed to child because
it's
environmental.
You know, it's great. It's like that. think of like a gradiated like color chart, right? I mean, right. You know, I'm just trying to be fair to it, right?
But in terms of producing it too, you know, it's pretty energy intensive. I mean,
it's not just the tar sands that are energy intensive anymore. The stuff that we're producing out in the Bakken in North Dakota, even though that's light oil, right? That's incredibly energy intensive because of the amount of capital that you have to put into one of those wells, and that capital is directly representative of energy. So, you know, in the Bakken, I'm trying to remember, there's a ratio of the amount of drill pipe you need relative to your oil production, right? The Bakken needs about 100 times as much drill pipe, right, as, you know, a vertical well in Texas circa 1950 would have used.
So wait, let's break it down kind of, you know, I'm the professional teacher here, so, you know, because we're kind of, so wait a minute. So first of all, what Corey's talking about here is that the efficiency, right? So there's this issue that we should be aware of, there's less and less of the kind of oil that is very cost-effective to produce, and we're more and more going to places extracting our oil in ways that we're really getting hardly any return to our investment, right? But of course, then we're, so that's one thing, right? It's extremely inefficient. We have to put in so much resources in order to get it out. Now, why do we do it? There's the element of private interests, often supported by government, often, always, that are allowed to benefit from it because they don't have to pay those large costs that Gary's talking about. But now, there is, maybe when they have to do pipes or have to dig deep or have to refine hard, things like that, perhaps. There they get subsidized and the free market is being subverted because, for example, they, in Canada, I don't know, they use a tremendous amount of water, right? And that water is probably cheap. Cheaper than it really values.
Well, in California, they do the same thing. If you go into California
is dying of lack of water.
That's right. Yeah, but they are. But the oil recovery there is incredibly water intensive.
Right. So you're saying don't just look at the tar sands. There's plenty of horrible stuff too.
Right.
But how about all the indigenous people and forests?
By the way, my own opinion, if you want to know who's blocking Keystone XL, it's the major U.S. banks, because a lot of the large U.S. banks, they've backed oil. They've probably got, I'd be willing to guess, hundreds of billions of dollars in loans out to companies that are drilling in the Bakken and that are drilling in, you know, some of these other tight oil formations like the Eagle Ford Shale, right? And these are areas where the marginal cost of production is probably $70 to $80 a barrel, conservatively, maybe even higher. Mm-hmm. You know, the marginal cost of production in Canada is probably $35 to $40 a barrel. But right now there's no pipeline capacity, right? They're having to ship the oil via rail car. And they are shipping it via rail car. Mm-hmm. So if you're worried about an oil spill, trust me, it's a lot more manageable if it's a pipeline than if it's a rail car. Right. So really, my opinion is the reason the administration is blocking Keystone XL this far, it's not to appease the environmentalists. Mm. It's not It's not to help, you know, the Canadian tar sands is going to be produced regardless of it. It's to basically bail out the U.S. banks again.
Right.
My own opinion.
Right. So that's a good point, right? So, you know, I'd also like to mention that these energy companies are also going into the Arctic to, you know, basically drill for oil. I think one of the CEOs of, you know, a major bank or a major financial company said that he was happy that the Arctic ice is melting because we would have access to that kind of stuff. Even though drilling it would, you know, has a risk of releasing tons of methane gas, or the melting of the ice rather.
I'm actually shocked that they're even. I mean, you know, even for an incredibly greedy industry that doesn't care about, you know, the environment, I'm actually shocked that they're drilling in the Arctic, because ice or not, that's an incredibly hostile environment. I mean, you know, it wouldn't take, look,
not for the people making the decisions.
No, the Deepwater Horizon, I mean, that sank in calm waters, right? I mean, you know, the Gulf of Mexico compared to the North
Sea. You're falling
is,
to that 20th century rational bias.
Rational, yeah.
You're thinking that the people are trying to solve or anything, or trying to run this planet
I'm thinking that they're worried about a $5 billion oil rig.
But
you write it off, you know, the potential profits are bigger. It's not like they're going to have to pay for the damage.
So I think their argument is that, you know, now that the ice is melting, right, we have the access to this oil, and they don't realize that the continued melting of the warming of the planet and the continued melting of the ice has a risk of, say, releasing methane gas.
By the way, which Ben, that link that you shared on my Facebook wall with Taleb, where he talks about the mathematical framework to debunk—I don't know how I put it on this on the air—but bogus economics.
Yeah,
it's also applicable to
because of the risk management element
to basically the risk management of climate change, right? And if you just kind of like have some sort of a mathematical background,
but again, if you have a government that's somewhat working, or king or dictator or fairy tales, I don't know, but somebody who's actually thinking, all right, you know, how can I make a lot of money running this planet, exploiting people? All right. But no, I mean, we don't even have that. I don't think that ever existed in the universe, you know, not in ancient Babylonia. A leadership that eats its, you know, that just rapes and pillages everything.
Eats its own.
You know, slave owners, they raped, they beat, they tortured, they maimed, but they didn't eat their people or they would go broke. So
I think this.
So let's put a little happiness out there. Next couple of minutes.
Give us a couple of minutes to capture out here. Collect ourselves.
All right, a little breather there. Welcome back to Punkonomics.
Nobody anyway, hears on antidepressants.
Jesse couldn't take it anymore. No, we're not on antidepressants. We're angry.
Everybody was prescribed. They didn't get any.
Yeah, I know. I refused to take them. Okay, so I've got, here's a cute story, and this one's from my wife, actually. She's awake. They're doing something interesting in France, and that'll open the discussion between some a little bit more techno-optimism and pessimism, and then I'll let them duke it out. They're repurposing a lot of anything that's not agriculture, a bit in the highways, on the side of the road, basically everywhere in France now. They're leaving it to prairie. So you don't have a nice planted shrubbery in the middle of the highway. It's just they're reinstating a brute prairie, so for the bees and the bugs and to rebuild the soil, 95% of it generally is gone. So why am I telling this story? First of all, it's a nice story of here. You can have policies that are in line with this sort of stuff. But then, nice, but is it enough? Technologically, first of all, and then do we have to give up on our air conditioning and our comfortable life in order to survive? Do we have to go back to hunter-gatherer societies, or is there hope? And if so, what is it?
So, I'm gonna start the discussion off and say that there isn't really any. I think that the technological fixes, if you understand how technology works, it's sold to us as like, hey, yeah, we'll solve this problem, and it's really good. And I can give you an example from personal experience with my medicines, right? So I take immunosuppressants and I take the drug prednisone to stop the inflammation of my liver. So if you're on prednisone for long term, right, I may solve the problem with my liver, but I have a bone density bone density problem. So with technology, it's a trade-off. It's, okay, do I want a liver or, am I willing to forego my bones and my skeletal structure, whatever and what have you, and take this miracle medicine? And I think that's the same. It's the same thing for the technologies that civilization kind of pushes on you, right? It's said to fix this problem, and then in trying to fix the problem, it either doesn't fix it efficiently, or it creates a brand new one that is unforeseen and that we never. We never took account of. So I think the technological fixes argument, while it's good and while it's important, I would argue that it would be important to give us a sort of a soft landing, if you will, is not something that will get us out of the crisis. It will delay the crisis for a little while, but I don't think it will get us out of the
That's already assuming that the world is not run by banksters and lobbyists, and somebody's actually really trying to solve our obvious problems. Right. So we're not even dealing with that political level of the issue, which is huge.
This is just a theoretical.
We're trying by all means, bring it in. I'm not saying don't deal with it, but I'm just pointing out that that's already somewhat optimistic.
So this is something that I've researched extensively, for a long time.
Energy geek.
I'm an energy geek. We cannot sustain the current global. The world is way beyond its carrying capacity, right? And what I mentioned off air, ultimately the limiting factor is the amount of phosphorus that's available to us. I mean, if you were long term sustainable, I'm guessing like maybe 1.5 to 2 billion people on Earth. That's what we got to pare it down to. Now, technology, in my opinion, can allow us to reach that number in a bit more of a comfortable fashion. Right, because of through technology, you can produce energy that otherwise wouldn't be available to humans. Right, now we're doing that in a very dirty way through extracting and burning fossil fuels. But there are other ways to do that. Right, solar power is there's a lot of potential there. I'm a big fan of nuclear. right? A lot of people don't understand nuclear. Nuclear is a very misunderstood technology. It's been very, very poorly deployed so far. We are the most promising and the safest and the most economical reactor designs we basically turned our backs on about 40 or 50 years ago simply because of the Department of Defense, not just here in the U.S., but you know, the Russian counterparts. They wanted to pursue light water reactors so that you know civilian nuclear reactors could double as plutonium factories for nuclear weapons. And as a result, we turned our back on if anybody's listening, Google the Lifter, LFTR. Lifter reactor. I mean, you know, if you had to come up with some sort of a cornucopian device to make things better in the world, that's about the closest thing you're going to find.
And I think on a point of order, like Chris Garlock last time followed up the show with a posting with wonderful
amount
of links.
So from now on, homework, people.
So just to support that too, what you're kind of talking about, I've read some of that from John Gray. John Gray, the economic philosopher from the LSE, he is in, I think in his book of political writings, Gray's Anatomy, he is not opposed to nuclear. And I think he outlines a very similar, I think all his other environmental positions are sort of absurd, where he's like, oh yeah, let the big corporations and the big banks take control over the oceans and it'll be fine. But on the nuclear issue, he's really, he provides one of the strongest arguments. But I think what I want to say is that I think we agree on technology helping us to get a soft sort of landing in terms of you know, limiting the population and preventing a crash and so on and so forth. But I think there are two things to take to take account of when you're using the energy. So I know that you're a proponent of nuclear, but for those who are not and who say, well, I would prefer to use solar power or wind energy or what have you.
Use all.
I think, and I'm going to put this in the context of a capitalist economy as well, too, right? So I'm going to bring that in. So for the people who say that, you do have to scale down when these technologies go into effect right now. You have to scale down the complexity of your civilization. Because I'll say why. Because the energy being produced, right, is not the at the same efficiency of, say, something like oil, right?
Well, the metric you're referring to is what's called EROEI, energy return on energy invested, right? And if you Google that, you'll see a lot of links to a website called The Oil Drum, which is where it's probably discussed the most. Now, there are a lot of different views on this, and one of them is that the complexity of society is relative to the EROEI, the energy return on energy invested, right? So higher EROEI, which would be like, you know, the oil we were pulling out of Saudi Arabia back in the 50s, 60s. Basically, you pull out 100 barrels of oil for every one barrel you put in. That's a simple metric. And the idea is that there's a very large amount of net energy available, and that net energy is what allows us to make society complex.
What is that exactly, by the way?
I'd like
to problematize. What is complex society? The fact that we juggle multiple jobs and...
Well, I mean, you know, you
have no time to hang with our families.
Well, let's...
You know what I mean? I'm challenging the notion that complex society... I want my air conditioning,
Here's what I would say is that...
I wanted to give it a really simple definition, right? So Ted Kaczynski, and also Heidegger as well, if you read their essays on technology, right, they sort of distinguish between two types of technology.
It's
right?
Interesting choices.
There are two interesting choices of people.
Yes!
The Unabomber and the German philosopher implicated in supporting the Nazis.
Yes! Only on this show.
That was the boring people, you know?
what can I say? A good argument is...
Is
a good argument. So they make a distinction between two types of technology. So there's the small scale technology, right? And I think Kaczynski gives an example of this in terms of, say, something like refrigeration, right? So on a small scale, right, you'd have, you know, your salting of meats and so on and so forth, and it's easy to replicate. So if society were destroyed tomorrow, you could, you know, we could institute that technology by ourselves. And then there's this sort of technology that depends on a state, on an entire infrastructure, right? So this is what he calls organizational dependent technology, right? So this would be something like, if civilization collapsed tomorrow, no matter how much physics you and I remembered,
we're not going to be able to produce a semiconductor.
We're not going to build a fridge. Like I'm sorry.
Nah, we could build a fridge. I could build a fridge, but we're not going to be able to build a microprocessor.
Right. So we're not going to, you know.
I mean, they were building fridges back in the 20s.
It's important to have friends that can make, you know, Corey here, you know, I'm recruiting him.
Okay, so maybe I read the Machinist Handbook,
you know,
so,
book of the 1800s.
So maybe Corey can, you know, like, create a fridge. But in terms of...
Make an engine, I can make a fridge, right. I can't make a semiconductor, I can't make a lot of, you know, complex pharmaceuticals. I see your point.
So that's what I mean by a complex society, a society that sort of depends on this sort of organization-dependent technology.
Would you fit like a production Walmart production, structure in the complex society? I was kind of thinking maybe that's something we could dispense of. You know, do we really need all the slave, you know, produced textiles? Right, we can just wear a few less clothes, no biggie, you know. Do we need access to all that shipping around the world?
The robots are probably going to make it anyways.
But in terms of in terms of the Walmart stuff, right? So, you know, someone like Jensen says there's a very sensible way to do this. We can stop subsidizing people like Walmart and subsidize local businesses instead.
Yeah, but that's the problem. I mean, that sounds great, but the problem is how do you define a local business? Because as soon as you define a local business, I guarantee you Walmart will figure out how to define itself as a local business.
Mom and Pop?
Yeah. There's a restaurant group. They have a restaurant here in Winter Park. It's the Houston's Group, or it's now maybe it's called the Hillstone Group, right? Mm. It was a chain of 54 restaurants around the United States. And, you know, with the recently passed, what's now called Obamacare, the owner of the Hillstone Group conveniently split the company in half, I think, into the Hillstone and the Houston's Group so that they could avoid some definition within the Obamacare thing, right? So, I mean, I like that idea, you know, subsidize. But the problem is that in this country, at least,
right,
as soon as you set a definition...
The corporations will.
You need a functional government subsidize
properly. But of course, we, you know, that presumes that we have a functional government. Yeah. It presumes that we have. J.W. Smith was pointing out that on the books, our laws allow Americans, right, in principle at least, a lot of bargaining power. And, you know, I don't know if we can elect someone from our own ranks to, you know, have the state and its resources operate within our interests and not in the interests of corporations. You know, I'm sure.
But Jay's making a fundamental, so again, I assume my professor attitude, a fundamental and important distinction between a radical thought and liberal thought in this case. In this case, we're talking about the radical left and a liberal. In a nutshell, you know, we might have the rules are okay, the constitution's all right, no problem. But power matters. We don't care about laws. It's like the best example, right? The typical example from Richard Wolff: re-regulate the economy. That's kind of what liberals say, right? Radicals say no, because the power is still completely maldistributed, and the powerful will be able to go around the rules legally, illegally, or deregulate them if they find them inconvenient.
I should mention that someone like J.W. Smith is an environmental economist, so I think you'd be interested in him. But he actually likes the idea of super efficient capitalism, right? So he doesn't think that capitalism is efficient enough, and he actually argues that the way to get that is that as private power grows and gets more and more concentrated, bargaining power has to grow alongside it so that it can provide a check on it and make it, you know, way more efficient. So in that sense, he's, you know, Derek Jensen had an interview with him. I don't know how he feels about him, but in that sense, I think he's a, you know, a bit of a liberal.
Yeah. Many conservatives, the good ones, the radical ones, I call out to say that. I mean, that's what they mean when they say corporatism. That they say, you know, they do believe in capitalism 100%, but this isn't it. You know, and they see what I keep shouting all the time, you know, that what we call globalization is not free market at all. It's not because we have big government. It's because we have capital allows to those who own capital, which is a very small minority of the population, have the flexibility of moving it around. So they outsource. But the labor that works, you know, those murdered girls in Bangladesh, that I keep mentioning, never got a chance to come and work in garment industry here. So labor can't move. So they are weakened fundamentally. This is not free market. This is not what Smith was talking about. Not at all.
The question I keep going back to is I mean, you know, a lot of people underestimate really what, you know, basically what cheap processing power is done. What happens when those jobs just don't exist? Yep. I mean, that's, I mean, I, you know, I look, Ben, totally for a while now, I totally get what you're saying, you know, with the balance between labor and capital. But, you know, I mean, really, we've become very, very good at making it so that labor doesn't matter anymore.
True that. True that. That's a major thing. You mentioned it before.
I mean, it's something that economists, I mean, really, we all have to, in my opinion, if we're going to be even relevant, I mean, look, people like Taleb blast economists for being totally useless and irrelevant, and I 100% agree with him because, by and large, the profession has been useless. I mean,
the mainstream.
The mainstream, right?
The mainstream. Yeah. Neoclassical and they're...
But, I mean, I actually think some economists have done a decent job of addressing the environmental side, right? At least there's been a discussion. But, I mean, nobody really wants to talk about the labor destruction. Maybe it's just because it's so uncomfortable. It's just, I mean, nobody wants to be...
You guys just did. I mean, I'm seeing the time. I want to bring out something, and we'll obviously have to spend more time on this topic. But just when we were, when Jesse couldn't take it anymore and put a nice groovy, you know, kind of clash reggae for us. So Jay was talking about a little bit what his medical example before. So, you know, if we have in Germany all over, we have those wonderful windmills and all over Europe, how wonderful, we feel good about ourselves. And it even produces clean energy, etc. But he was mentioning that they use rare metals that are then used, that are mined in Congo, and you know, we've killed millions of people, mass rape of babies. No, I mean, it used to be that you say rape of babies, it's like, oh yeah, okay, over the top language. No, they rape babies there by the hundreds on a regular basis, have been doing for a long time, and the West is supporting them because we want those rare metals in the earth there. So yeah, and then Corey comes back and says, well, yeah, because he knows exactly what kind of special engine magnet is the one using these rare metals for which we do that sort of thing. And then he's saying, but you know what? Why are we really needing these rare metals? Corey said a moment ago, because if we just use regular metals and regular dynamos, it'll just be a little bit more maintenance, really.
Yeah,
and
but
that's a good thing, isn't it? Yeah, why don't we then...
But I'm talking about creating, like... I'm talking about creating, like, one more job over the course of like 30 years. I mean, we're really talking about not even drops in a bucket, right? Because, I mean, you know, the neodymium direct drive turbines, they only need to have their bearings serviced on an annual basis. The genset itself is good basically indefinitely. Those that are driven by a gearbox, I mean, you're talking about changing out the gearbox every like 15 years.
Okay, but it's political choice. How about we have somebody in charge of painting them pretty.
Now there you go. There
every
you
day.
Go. I mean, basically,
saying,
now
political but, decision that now, the people need jobs. Now, it'll make here's for my a critique. Good world in which
here's,
we live.
Here's my critique of that, though, is that I think that we're relying too much on human past, right, as a narrative for what we need to be in the future. We need to have, because the narrative there is that we need to have jobs. There needs to be employment because there always has been, right? And it's a societal thing. It's a cultural thing. I think that paints, I think that's like, it's a fake solution, if you will. Because of, in my opinion, I think once automation has has invaded production enough, right? Once it's displaced enough labor, people will realize that those jobs are fake. And if we keep on feeding them fake jobs, I think that you could have a collapse. Some might say that's a good thing. But the thing is I think as economists, we really need to start looking in the terms of there is no employment.
We could go J.S. Mill, right? So J.S. Mill talks about this in some of his economic works. And his hope was that as civilization got more complex and, you know, automation got rid of labor, right, what people would do is go off and, you know, I don't know, pursue their own interests, you know, I don't know, do more science or make new breaks in mathematics or philosophy or what have you. And, you know, they'd use their leisure to, right, you know, harness their creativity. And he said that while they do that, we can, you know, I'm gonna
hijack the last minute of the show real quick. So I've
next week. Yeah. Continue. Right?
Good. Go for
do
it.
Do I have a minute?
Yeah,
make it quick. It's not gonna be quick.
Okay, yeah. Leave it on a cliffhanger. You know, we'll talk about that, and we'll let's go next week. I'm actually in town. It's the week after I'm out of town. So next week, let's just continue.
You're gonna miss
story.
My graduation.
Yes, I will miss your graduation. That's what I'm aware of that.
I think Charlotte's coming up.
That's okay. I'll send you the video.
All right. We've got to get out of here. Make room. See you next week. Bye.
Thank you, everybody. Have a great weekend. You have just tuned into Punkonomics, of course, on WPRK, Winter Park, Florida.